Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Damn Radio. If you'd like to call in, please do. Call 573-746-8020 or email live at damradio.com. This is Jack's Car Show. I'm broadcasting live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. This is Damn Radio. So, tonight's show, I'm mostly going to focus on smart makers of what is commonly referred to as the smart car, you know. I want to talk about why it was made and the events leading up to its creation and also some of the cool features of the car, because it seems like the world just collectively forgot about how weird these things were. But first, I want to just talk about some miscellaneous stuff. So I'm going to talk about cars in movies and mistakes that are made that kind of that don't. Some of them bother me, some of them don't. But I talked last week about Lamborghini, and one of the things I talked about was in The Wolf of Wall Street, they crashed a real Lamborghini Countach because Martin Scorsese didn't want to take away from the realism of the movie by using a replica. He wanted it to be as real as possible, as if anybody's going to know what crash damage would look like. I mean, not even a Countach owner would know what a Countach looks like when it's been crashed. So why would you waste a perfectly good one for a 20-second scene that takes place in the dark? It's for realism, apparently. But you want to talk about realism? Well, Mr. So-called Martin, so-called Scorsese, explain this. I forgot about this when I brought that up last week, but about a month ago, I was watching Casino, which is another Martin Scorsese movie, and I noticed this. In that movie, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a scene where Sharon Stone goes on a tirade and gets the cops called on her, and she leaves her house, then goes to the bank where she empties out her safety deposit box full of jewelry. Well, that scene is supposed to take place in 80 or 81, remember that, and I forgot to get a timestamp for this, but one of those shots around that bank, way off in the background behind some bushes, there's clearly the roofline of a Mitsubishi Starion. And those didn't come to the States until 83. But it gets worse, because you can clearly tell by the mirror that it's a wide body, and the wide bodies didn't come out in the U.S. until 86. And so that just took me completely out of the realism of the movie. It's just an insult to our intelligence. I mean, does Martin Scorsese think we're all retarded? Are we to believe that's some kind of magic Starion? You know, I'm kind of kidding, but I mean, not really. That one's not that bad, because it's not, I mean, it's not like a, it's not in, you'd have to look for it. I mean, it's not just a thing you randomly spot unless you're looking for it, which I tend to be. But there's a whole load of car mistakes in movies if you're really paying attention. Another thing that always gets me about movies, and it's not even really the studio's fault. It's, arguably, it's not even a mistake, but it's just like when you're watching a movie that's set, say, 30 or 50 years ago, the only cars that ever seem to be present are always just cool, interesting ones, because that's all anybody bothered to preserve, you know? All the cheap, crappy, insignificant stuff just ended up in junkyards. Like the other day, I saw a guy driving a first-generation Kia Sportage around Osage Beach, and that actually drew my attention. I was, like, happy to see it, because that has to be the only one still in existence. Most of them are just rusted away in junkyards somewhere. You know, in general, the only cars that actually stick around are either interesting, like sports cars, muscle cars, and stuff like that, or just really reliable cars. Like, I constantly see Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierras everywhere. Yeah, and that's the little cheap Oldsmobile sedan from, I want to say, mid-80s to mid-90s. But apparently that's one of, like, the most reliable cars ever made, judging by just how many are still around. I see them daily. But that's just an exception. Mostly all the regular crap just kind of ceases to exist. But if you only watch modern movies that are set 50 years ago, your impression of what the past was like is that every single person drove around in Mustangs and Corvettes and Chargers and things. Even though in real life, just like today, 50 years ago, the streets were filled with normal stuff that nobody ever thinks about and nobody bothered to preserve. And so that's something I think about when I watch movies, you know, period pieces. It's just how many interesting cars there tend to be in one small location and just kind of how unrealistic that is. But that doesn't ruin the movie for me. You know what actually ruined part of a movie for me, though? I was recently watching Dallas Buyers Club. And it's a movie where, if you've never seen it, Matthew McConaughey has AIDS and he's trying to smuggle and sell experimental medications that haven't been approved by the FDA. And it's set, I think the entire movie is set between 1985 and 1987. And so anyway, in that movie, he runs his whole operation out of a little motel room. And in those scenes, he's sitting at a desk, and right behind his head, there's a poster of a Lamborghini Aventador. Again, this scene takes place in probably 86 or 87, right? And it's not like a little tiny print. It's not small or subtle, like nobody noticed it. It's probably a 4x3 poster, and it's right behind his head. It's like the focal point of the whole shot. How? I can understand how you, sometimes they'll accidentally leave modern cars like a block down the street from where the actors are standing just out of view, and you can barely see them. You see that occasionally. If I was making a movie, I wouldn't allow that, but it's not that uncommon if you're paying attention to certain movies. But I don't understand how nobody picked up on a massive poster of a 2011 automobile stuck at head level directly behind the lead actor. That actually did bother me. And there's a lot of mistakes studios make with cars and period set movies. Some of them I understand. Like, you know, sometimes they're not thinking and they depict a car as all faded and beat up. But technically, if you know, it's supposed to be in the movie a relatively new car, you know. You see that occasionally. Or say the movie's set in 1988 and they show a Subaru SVX, right? It kind of fits with that vibe, but it technically wasn't out yet, okay? The other day I was watching a show and it had a first generation Dodge Neon. And they depicted the rear windows as being completely open. And everybody in the Neon community knows those rear windows like barely roll down. Because the shape of the door, it makes it so the window only really goes down maybe 5 inches. And so for filming, obviously, they just remove the window. But that's kind of a thing you have to know, you know. 90% of people aren't going to pick up on that. But the fact is, a Lamborghini Aventador is a big flagship supercar. Everybody knows what it is. 8-year-old children know what a Lamborghini Aventador is. Granted, they're probably not watching Dallas Buyers Club, but everybody knows what an Aventador is. How'd they screw that up? They had like 2 people working on the editing staff, and just presumably dozens or hundreds of people saw that before the movie was ever released to the public. And I guess not one of them thought to say anything. So I guess Scorsese has a point. People do notice that stuff, but I've never seen what a crashed Countach looks like, so I can't really... I guess I've seen Wolf of Wall Street, so I do know what a crashed Countach looks like, but I hadn't before, so you didn't have to destroy a real one. Most people aren't going to know what it looks like in any case. In other news, I was on eBay, and I was looking for some General Motors EV1 promotional stuff just to see what's out there. You know, the EV1 doesn't exist anymore. And I discovered somebody's currently trying to sell an EV1-shaped cookie jar. And I think it's great. You know, it's not even an EV1, it's an Impact, actually. It's the concept pre-production version of the EV1, and that's even cooler. And you know, it was the cookie jar was custom-made. It wasn't officially licensed GM merchandise, so I don't think it's $350 cool. That's what they're asking, but, I mean, it's cool. If it was $50 or $75, of course I'd have bought it on the spot. I mean, why would I not want a GM EV1 cookie jar? It's awesome. But anyway, I just thought that was fun. But moving on, I've been seeing headlines in the past week or so about how Dodge is talking about building a small $30,000 sports car. Like an actual sports car, which is hilarious because they've never actually done that. There's not a single instance of Chrysler ever building a real sports car. Arguably the Viper, you know? It's more of a muscle car to me. And, you know, I guess the Prowlers, I don't even know what it's just a cruiser. I don't even know what you call a Prowler. It's not really a sports car. To me, the closest that Chrysler ever came to making a sports car was 20 years ago with the Chrysler Crossfire, which was mostly a Mercedes SLK underneath. Although, to be fair, the Crossfire, people forget that. The Crossfire was more sporty than the SLK. The Crossfire Coupe had a stiffer chassis than a Porsche 911 at the time. It wasn't just a Mercedes SLK. You know, the Crossfire wasn't as bad as everybody thinks. I actually think they're pretty cool. The problem the Crossfire really had was it was an old platform as soon as it came out because it seems like people have in their minds that the Crossfire and the SLK are, you know, they're twins and they were made at the same time by the same people and they were sold at the same time. They weren't because the first generation SLK was the R170. It came out in 97 and it was discontinued after the 2004 model year. But the 2004 model year was the first model year of the Crossfire. And so Crossfire came out as the SLK it was based on was going out of production. They were doing a new SLK. And so the Crossfire comes out. It's in 2004, but it's basically a 1997 automobile, so it's already outdated. But it was cheap. I mean, you know, at least compared to everything else it might have competed with, you know, Audi TT, BMW Z4, that sort of thing. It was cheaper than that stuff. It wasn't better than that stuff, but it was cheaper than that stuff. But it was still more money than a 350Z or a Mustang, and so nobody bought it. And so now Dodge has been spreading some rumors that they're toying with the notion of building a sports car. In fact, the word build, of building a sports car, which I might believe that Chrysler would do that if for no other reason than they would be entering the sports car market at the complete wrong time, which seems like a very Chrysler thing to do. nobody's buying sports cars anymore. But I don't think this project is ever going to be anything. I guess they just did it to get people to talk about it, and I am, so, you know, fair enough. But anyway, after the last show, I talked about old Lamborghinis and Ferraris, and so I naturally got online and started looking at old Lamborghinis and Ferraris, and I'm still surprised at how cheaply you can get a Ferrari 308, because I'm surprised those aren't well into six figures now. Like, 80 grand gets you a good one, and I mean, you know, that's a lot of money, but that's a cool car for 80 grand. Magnum PI had one. It's a gorgeous car. It's iconic. What, 80 grand? Go look in the realm of supercars for $80,000. There's not really that many options. This thing's cool. But anyway, I've been thinking about doing this for a while. You know, if I had infinite money, I wouldn't want a good one. Even if you get one that's like mint and running properly, and that is probably six figures. What do they make, like 240 horsepower? I mean, it depends on the year probably, but what I really would like to do at some point in my life, if I ever had enough money, is take a 70s or 80s Ferrari 308 GTS or a Maserati Merak or even later a Series 3 Lotus Esprit and just some old, good-looking, not especially desirable mid-engine supercar, preferably one that doesn't run, and just have somebody swap in a VR6, a Volkswagen six-cylinder, or one of the lesser-known Volkswagen 07Ks, you know, the five-cylinder that they put in the Golf and things later on. I don't know why nobody's done that. I think that'd be perfect. Because I'm really into both those engines lately, because they were both designed for front-wheel drive applications, just little hatchbacks. But they're cool. You know, either of those engines, with a couple of bolt-ons and a tune, you can make double what, you know, those Ferraris and things made new. I mean, you know, it's not like, and you don't lose what made the car cool in the first place, because if you were to swap in, say, a Honda K-Series or something like that, you know, you make a ton of power, but it sounds really lame, and it's, everybody's done it. Same with the EV swap. That's not true of either of those Volkswagen engines. I mean, keep in mind, they were originally put in little economy cars, Golfs, Beetles, and things, but I'll place the exhaust notes for you. They're pretty sick. You know, they were in Beetles and things. I mean, they were just little economy cars, but you can just as easily picture these sounds coming from a 70s Ferrari or Maserati. You know, the VR6 sounds like this. Imagine that out of a 70s Ferrari 308. And now, the 07K is the inline 5, and it's a 2.5 liter. And so everybody says architecturally it's half the V10 from a Lamborghini Gallardo, which is probably why it sounds like this. They both sound exotic. They both sound really cool. And you know, you put those in an old supercar, which don't weigh that much, and the car would be faster and better to drive and way easier to maintain. And the engines are small, which is great, because, I mean, so was the original engines in all those cars. So, as somebody who's never done an engine swap, how hard can it be? I've never swapped an engine before, but I see no reason why nobody has done one of those swaps. I think it'd be perfect, but anyway. So, moving on to the main subject matter of the show, I want to talk about smart. So, the other day I was looking at cool, you know, cheap cars that people are going to be able to import into the U.S. in the next couple of years. And so, naturally, I started looking at smart roadsters, which those will be available to us in about, I think, August 2002 is when they started making those. So, say, you know, about 3 years by the time you can actually get, by the time you actually have a choice of which one you buy, you know. Because it goes by build date, the 25-year rule. So, it's like, you know, if you have a 2002 automobile, it doesn't, okay, so say there's a 2000 model year car that I want to buy, but it's July 2000. Well, technically, I can't import it yet, even though it's 25, you know, years, quote unquote. It's still not exactly 25 years. That's how it goes. And so about 3 years, you're going to be able to get a smart roadster, which is cool. And so then I started thinking about, okay, well, there's a handful of weird smart branded vehicles out there that Americans never got, because the vast majority of Americans, even if they know nothing about it, they know about the smart 4 too, the smart car. It's an icon. And if you say smart car, people know. It's the one. People instantly know what you're talking about. even if people confuse it with a Scion IQ. But the thing is, there were a handful of smart cars. I mean, it's just the wheel never got the one smart model. So I want to talk about the smart car, the brand, how it came to be, and why it pretty much failed. So the story really starts in the 70s. And it doesn't have anything to do with cars. I've touched on this a little bit before the show, But it's not car related. It's the quartz crisis of the 70s, and it was a big deal in the watch world. And so, just like in the world of cars, motorcycles, consumer electronics, everything at the time, the Japanese showed up pretty much overnight and started dominating the watch industry. And so, in the year 1968, half the watches sold in the world were made in Switzerland. They were the country that made watches. That was Switzerland's whole shtick. You know, that and helping Americans commit tax evasion. But when it came to watch technology, Switzerland was on the cutting edge. The cutting edge, of course, being old-fashioned mechanical movements at the time. But within the industry, there started being a push toward electronic watches. It really started back in 1957 when Hamilton released the Electric 500, most famously in the Ventura case. People in the watch world always assumed that, you know, the Hamilton Ventura is culturally significant because Elvis had one. And he did, but no, that wasn't the reason. It's significant because it was the first battery-powered watch. It was a big deal. And I'm not even going to pretend to understand how it worked. Because I only really have a loose understanding of how a watch movement works in general. But from what I've heard, in the simplest of terms, it was basically just a regular mechanical movement, except they figured out how to power it with a battery. And it was a big deal. Although they never caught on. You know, it was a first attempt. You give them credit. But it was expensive, which, I mean, okay, fair enough. But they weren't the most reliable things in the world. And the whole battery-powered thing was kind of just a gimmick at the time. Because they had to custom make a battery for that watch. Nobody, you know, watch batteries weren't really a thing. They had to have that made. You know, so nobody was really interested. Or so it seemed until Bulova unveiled their Accutron in 1960. And the Accutron used a tuning fork movement, which is another thing I'm not going to try and pretend to understand how it works. But, you know, in this case, it was nifty because, you know, everything else, everything was mechanical back then. So everything, all the watches had a pretty smooth sweep, you know, 6 or 8 seconds or 6 or 8 ticks per second, you know. But this thing was ridiculously smooth. Like, the watch didn't tick. You know, even a mechanical watch where it looks like it's smooth, it's like, you know, it's really, it ticks quickly. But this one didn't. The Accutron hummed. It was how smooth it was. But the thing was, the Accutron was still kind of expensive, and it was impractical, and it was, but it was incredibly accurate for the time. I mean, plus or minus 2 seconds a day, which at the time, that was, a Rolex was probably the most accurate watch you could get back then, and it was plus or minus 5 or 6 seconds a day. And a Timex, forget about it. I mean, a Timex at the time was plus or minus 30 seconds a day. And so this Accutron got people within the industry thinking about this sort of thing. And in fact, the tuning fork even seemed to kind of catch on a little bit. I remember looking at some 60s Omegas that had tuning fork movements. It was a cool technology, but that was nothing because the next big advancement was the quartz movement. And you know, prior to watches, you know, quartz clocks had been around for a few decades. It's just that nobody knew how to do it compactly enough to fit it into a watch until the 60s. Because a quartz movement, I kind of understand how it works. Basically, it just works off the principle that when you send an electric current through a quartz crystal, it vibrates at an incredibly precise, incredibly consistent frequency. 32,768 vibrations per second. So essentially within the watch, you got the battery that sends electricity through a quartz crystal that always vibrates at the same rate. And then it's also got just a little tiny little basic computer that just counts those vibrations, and then when it hits its target, 32,768, the computer tells a little electric motor to spin the movement forward 1 second. And so, with technology being what it is now, it doesn't sound like that big a deal, but to get technology into something that fits on your wrist in the 60s was mad science. It wasn't that easy. And so, there was some pretty intense competition to be the first company to put it into a watch, but ultimately the first watch to bring that technology to market was the 1969 Seiko Astron. And the Astron was cool. I mean, you know, nowadays we're all bored of quartz watches just like ticking once every second, you know. But you think about it, when every other watch in the world ticks 6 or 8 times a second, but you show up one day wearing a watch, it ticks 1, 2, 3. Like, that, it was wild. You know, the main thing though is it was accurate. Because remember when I said a Rolex at the time was accurate to 5 or 6 seconds a day? Well, the Seiko was accurate to 5 or 6 seconds a month. And so the Astron comes out, and it costs, you know, it costs Rolex money, but it takes the watch world by storm. And quartz technology just becomes all the rage. And then 6 months later, Hamilton comes out with the Pulsar. And that was the first digital watch, and it used LEDs, which was also bananas at the time, and it cost a fortune. And so, there, you know, it's a cool thing, but it's kind of a boutique, expensive thing for rich people. And so the quartz technology didn't take off overnight because it was just so expensive to develop at first. But gradually, the actual buying public kind of warmed up to quartz watches, and the companies that focused on it were able to refine it and make it cheaper and more accessible. But, you know, the Swiss watch industry just basically acted like it was a fad. You know, it's like, prior to, say, the 90s, Sears was everywhere. They were everything, and it, to all people, they were, they should have been Amazon. But Sears thought the internet was just a fad. Well, the Swiss thought quartz watches were just a fad. You know? And so the Swiss continued to focus on craftsmanship and build quality and complex mechanical movements. And the Japanese just went right on ahead, paving the way forward for quartz. And so over time, with further development, I mean, the quartz movements that were so impressive because of accuracy and reliability became cheaper and easier to deal with, you know, than whatever the equivalent mechanical, you know, equivalent was. And so, you know, for example, I mean, the original Hamilton Pulsar, when it came out, it cost more than a Rolex. But within a few short years, that basic technology had been refined and trickled down and to the point where, you know, you were buying your middle school kid a cheap Casio digital watch as a Christmas present they didn't even ask for. So the super accurate, well-engineered watch had kind of just been democratized. And so, as you might imagine, that wasn't super great for the Swiss watch industry, which was almost entirely focused on mechanical stuff, which I guess isn't totally fair. The Swiss did, you know, try to keep up with stuff like, they had the Omega Electro Quartz and the Rolex Oyster Quartz, but it was for nothing, because why would I spend thousands of dollars on a Rolex when I could get the same or better performance from a Seiko for hundreds of dollars, or Casio for dozens of dollars? Why would I want a quartz Rolex? But, you know, still, Rolex and brands like it decided they'd simply double down and focus on just making the nicest watches they could, pretty much as luxury items. And it worked out for them, for sure. But not at the time. I mean, the 70s were a rough couple of years for them. And so, as a result of all that, within a decade, half of all the Swiss... within a decade, half of all Swiss watchmakers, a hard thing to say, half of them had shut down. And so, remember when I said at the end of the 60s that 50% of the watches sold in the world were Swiss? Well, 10 years after that, that number was down to 15%. And so it looked for a while like the Swiss watch industry was dead, because most companies were headed toward total collapse, and no one wanted to, you know, no one wanted to bail them out or loan them any money, because they're not selling watches. How are they going to pay, you know, pay back the loan? And there was even a time when the Japanese brands considered buying some of the Swiss brands, but it didn't really work out. But from the ashes of the dumpster fire that was the Swiss watch industry rose one. It was Swatch. I mean, really, it was several. Because the Swatch Group itself is kind of just the AMC or the British Leyland or Audi of the watch world. Just a whole load of little independent fledgling watchmakers that kind of joined one another over time to become a big conglomerate. And what happened was that, you know, by the early 80s, there were basically two big Swiss watch conglomerates. There was ASUAG, which stood for some preposterously long German phrase that I'm not going to try and say. And there was, and that was the corporate umbrella under which, you know, several companies, including Longines, and the big thing was ETA. ETA was one of the world's biggest watch movement manufacturers. That was a big thing. And the other corporation was SSIH, which had Tissot and Omega and a few other watch brands. And so, you know, there was increasing pressure from the Swiss government and the banks that these companies owed money to get them to join up and become one big thing. You know, like they had tried to do to save British Leyland, except this worked. And so the two companies merged to become, it's a really clever name, ASUAG/SSIH. But it would later be renamed the Swatch Group, which is how I'm going to refer to it because it's easier. But the man who was appointed to run all this was a guy named Nicholas Hayek. And Nicholas Hayek is kind of the Lee Iacocca of the watch world. He became CEO of what I'm just going to call the Swatch Group in 1983. And he immediately announced plans to launch a new brand called Swatch. And Swatch watches were supposed to be cool and fashionable and just fun. That was the whole point, you know. The name Swatch means second watch, implying that you have your fun little multicolored quartz-powered fashion statement, or several of them, and then for special occasions, you have your actual nice, expensive, automatic, you know, Omega or Breguet, which the Swatch Group also sold. That's great. That was kind of the idea, anyway. And so, these little cheap Swatch watches came out in 83, and they become popular almost immediately. Because, you know, they're just cheap, fun little quartz watches. I mean, the Japanese know how to do a lot of things. But I don't know. Fun tends to not be near the top priority, you know, because, I mean, everybody was buying Casios and things like that. But, I mean, you know who was buying digital watches in the late 70s, early 80s? Eric Foreman from That 70s Show. And people like him. And so as a fashion item, they kind of fell out of style somewhat quickly. People just wanted, they wanted, of course, watches, but they wanted just fun, weird color combinations and just cheap watches that they could buy a bunch of. And, you know, it wasn't the end of the world if something happened to them, you know. And so they sold really well. Sales were good. But to be fair, Rolex and companies and other companies like it were right. You know, quartz watches were kind of a fad. I'm not saying that they didn't catch on and they don't sell in massive numbers. I mean, to this day, 85% of watches sold globally in a given year are quartz. They obviously outsell. But when it comes to the luxury stuff, people with money just wanted craftsmanship, and they, you know, they want complex mechanical movements that, you know, because they're cool. And so ultimately, once the hype around super accurate quartz watches had kind of died down, people with money came back just wanting a nice, well-made, cool watch like a Rolex or Omega. And it's probably just down to the fact that for so many years, watches in general were just a tool. You know, it's only really in recent decades that watch collecting as a hobby has really taken off in the mainstream. And so people nowadays appreciate the kind of stuff they didn't back in the 70s, apparently, you know. Being into watches is a pretty common thing now. So as a result, those Swiss luxury watchmakers are doing better than ever. I think in terms of total, you know, volume sales, the number of watches made in Switzerland is still a pretty low percentage of global sales. But in terms of dollar amount, the Swiss make about 50% of the money there is to be made in the watch business. They're doing all right. Because, you know, as everybody got phones and things, I mean, it's like watches just became so much more of a status symbol and a hobby. And so, you know, I mean, nowadays, even the Swatch brand itself is trying to get into the enthusiast watch market. They got the Omega Swatch, Moon Swatch. I've got one of those. It's great. You know, the Moon Swatch. It's not very good, but it's great, you know? It's just fun. That's really all Swatch watches are for. It's just fun. It's just silly, cheap fun. And in the world of watches in the 80s, that was enough to save the entire Swiss watch industry. And so, with all that in mind, Nicholas Hayek realized, why not just make a car in the same way? You know, he thought there was a huge gap in the market for a small, fashionable, cheap car. And he wasn't wrong, because in the past, that gap had been filled by stuff like the Mini or the original Fiat 500. But those had gone out of production or were going out of production, and they weren't selling any kind of numbers. And anyway, they were bigger than what he wanted. I say that the Fiat 500 was well out of production. The Mini, I think, existed in certain markets until the early 2000s. But in any case, Hayek wanted just a cool, funky, tiny little city car. He wanted it from the get-go to be a small, practical, cheap car, but mainly he wanted it to be a fashion accessory, you know, because that was the mentality that had made Swatch so successful. So he figured, why not just do the same thing with a car, you know? And so he had a plan to create such a car. And so the smart car was born. I'll get to that after the break. So you're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.
Reality burns the way you were living. it's now or never. Too close to the ladder. We're all living proof and nothing lasts. Here for now. Transient tomorrow.
So I'm back. So before the break, Nicholas Hayek, CEO of Swatch, pretty much saved the entire Swiss watch industry, and he did it by making cheap, fashionable little watches. And so he wondered why nobody was doing that with cars, and so Hayek decided he wanted to do just that. And so he decided he wanted to get into contact with, he got into contact with a handful of automakers, Renault, BMW, Chrysler, there were a few others, but nobody was interested except for Volkswagen. And truthfully, this partnership could have been a match made in heaven, because really, in the past, everything people liked about Swatch, people liked about Volkswagen. They were just kind of cool and different. And so they were in talks with VW for quite a while until Ferdinand Piëch took over as CEO in 93. And, you know, Piëch saw the plans for the project, and he took one look and he was like, what the hell is this? This is dumb. We're not doing that. And so Piëch wanted nothing to do with it. And so Swatch got into contact with Mercedes-Benz, who thought it sounded like a good idea. And so in 1994, Swatch Group officially partnered with Mercedes to form the Micro Compact Car AG. And it wasn't such a bad idea for a partnership either, because Mercedes had kind of been toying with the idea of a tiny little city car, you know, two-seat city car since the 70s. So they were kind of into it. Plus, Mercedes themselves were hard at work developing a different little city car, the original Mercedes A-Class. You know, so they weren't exactly running blind into this. They seemed to, it was in line with what Mercedes wanted. And so when it came to the Smart, it took them 4 years from the time they partnered up to the time it actually went on sale. And there were a bunch of prototypes and concepts in between. The closest concept to the actual production 4.2 was the 1997 Smart Fashion Victim concept, which I couldn't care less about concepts. I think they're all kind of stupid. But to be honest, I just think that one's just a hilarious name, the Fashion Victim concept. But speaking of names, so Hayek wanted the brand name of the car to simply be Swatch, but Mercedes owned 51% of the shares of this new company, so they weren't just going to call it Swatch. They wanted to call it something different, and so they decided to call it Smart, which is equally dumb. I mean, obviously, it sounds really annoying and smug, but it means Swatch Mercedes Art, which, you know, it's the gayest thing I've ever heard, but I mean, for Mercedes, that's still a pretty decent name, because usually Mercedes is trash at abbreviations like that. You know, Mercedes, what I always thought was hilarious about Mercedes was Command, which was what Mercedes called their infotainment system from late 90s up until past couple of years. And Command is an acronym, right? It's spelled C-O-M-A-N-D. It's the word Command minus an M. And so guess what it stands for? You know, it controls your stereo and your navigation, some other car functions. What do you think Command stands for? No, you're wrong. Command stands for Cockpit Management and Data System. which is like, it's CMADS or CMDS, but Mercedes says it's command. So, you know, at least smart, you know, doesn't just randomly add or subtract letters in order to work. But Hayek wanted the car to be electric, and electric cars were not really a thing at the time. I mean, their early partner was Volkswagen, and they had some experience with the Golf. They had a Golf City Strommer, and they sold maybe dozens of those, and they were kind of a joke. But, you know, Volkswagen had worked on electric cars before, but, you know, Mercedes really didn't. And, I mean, at the time, the standard battery technology for any electric car was lead acid, which was pretty terrible. I mean, you know, it's, keep in mind, the Smart debuted in 1998. And so what other electric cars existed around that time? The GM EV1, Honda EV Plus, the RAV4 EV, Santa Fe EV, Nissan Altra EV, Ranger EV, S10 EV. They were all just jokes. They were all just CARB compliance cars. Maybe the best among them got 70 miles of range. Although, you know, arguably that's not that bad, because what Smart's trying to do is make a little city car. You don't need to go that far. But, you know, again, lead acid batteries. Lead acid batteries, they weigh a bunch and they have a horrible service life. I mean, think about the battery in your car. How often do you have to replace that? It's the same basic technology. And so, and some EVs had nickel metal hydride, which that was a little better, but for what they were trying to do, it seemed like too much work. It wasn't that realistic. And so Mercedes figured they would just work on making an electric version at a later date. They decided that when the car went to market, there would be a gasoline, a diesel, a hybrid, and then later an electric version. And when the car actually went on sale, only two of those were true. When the Smart was released in 1998, the thing was, it was pretty conventional, except mechanically, I mean, it was pretty standard, except it had the engine was at the back of the car, you know, to make it fit. And so there were essentially two engine options. There was a 600cc gas-powered, you know, turbocharged three-cylinder, and there was an 800cc three-cylinder turbo diesel. And at launch, there were two versions of that gas engine. There was one with 44 horsepower and one with 50 horsepower, and neither of them were really enough. And then 2 years after that, they came out with another version of that engine, except this time it had a snarling, fire-breathing 60 horsepower. But that wasn't the top engine either, because Brabus, who was a famous Mercedes-Benz tuning company, they developed a 71 horsepower version. And they put that in the Brabus Smart Car and also the Crossblade. I'll get to the Crossblade. But, you know, the Brabus version was cool. It had different wheels and a body kit and some suspension and, you know, slightly more powerful engine. It was a cool little car. You know, and you look at the Smart, and you assume it'll just be a riot to drive, but, like, when it came out, the fastest version did 0 to 60 in 11 seconds, and in most versions did it in 16 and a half. It wasn't quick. I mean, okay, 0 to 60 is not that big a deal. It's a city car, you know, really the 0 to 30 is what you really care about, and that's why the top speed's only 84 miles an hour across all models, but the main thing was every Smart came with a 6-speed single-clutch automated manual, which was all the rage at the time. But nobody liked it at the time. That was the weird thing, you know. And so Smart puts this in this car. It's just as terrible as every other automated manual out there. BMW SMG, Maserati Cambio Corsa, Toyota SMT. They were all pretty bad. It was the early 2000s. It was a bad time for transmissions. Because the technology was advanced enough that they could do automated manuals. But it was primitive enough that nobody could do them well. And in this car, that was pretty much the only solution they had. They had this one transmission, you know, for size reasons. They couldn't get anything else to work, you know. And so there was no manual transmission or any actual automatic transmission, just the automated manual. And by the way, pretty much all of those transmissions I just mentioned were terrible, but at least they allowed you to put them in automatic mode. But in the Smart, that was an option. You know, it was the same transmission, whichever one you got. But if you didn't pay for automatic mode, you just had to sit there and press a button to change gear every single time, up and down, just like driving a manual. But without any of the actual precision or flexibility or fun of a manual transmission, it was bad. And in the Smart, it handled reasonably well, like you'd expect. I mean, when the Smart went on sale in Europe, it was the lightest car available. You know, it weighed 1,600 pounds. The thing was light. And, I mean, 1,600 pounds. The handling could probably be affected by, for example, the amount of paper in your insurance booklet or, you know, or whether or not you sneezed before you got into the car. I mean, the thing weighed nothing. And it didn't even need power steering as a result. I mean, it was optional, but the car was so light that you didn't even need power steering. People couldn't necessarily tell the difference. So it wasn't much of a point. But I mean, handling wise, the car was really top heavy and the engine was at the back, and so there's no weight over the front, so it tended to understeer. It wasn't a sports car. It, you know, it's fine because it wasn't really supposed to be. But I mean, Mercedes was really all in on this thing. They went to the trouble of designing and building an all new factory for the smart production. In fact, the factory line existed, and like around it, there were a bunch of buildings which housed their parts suppliers. And so the parts and the cars were all made in the same place. They called it Smartville. Again, weird names. But in Europe, they had smart dealers. We never got smart dealers here, but in Europe they did. And they had big glass towers containing cars. And everybody thought it was just wild when Carvana did it a couple years ago, but Smart was doing it 25 years ago. And Mercedes put effort in. And the name of the car, so everybody calls it the Smart Car. It was originally called the Smart City Coupe. But I mean, so people in the United States only know it as the Smart 4.2 because they started selling it here in 2008. But that's because, so a couple of years prior to that, in 2002, they renamed the City Coupe to be the Smart 4.2 because they were planning on coming out with a four-door version called the 4.4, which makes sense, I guess. Something I only just discovered is that 4.2 and 4.4 literally just mean the car is 4.2 or 4.4. So, you know, the two-seat version is 4.2. I hate Smart's naming convention. Everything is just deliberately fruity. But Smartville and the name of the car is Smart. God. But the design. It's not like I need to discuss the design of the Smart because it's just, it was so iconic. The thing was short. Like, actually short. The original Smart 4.2 was 6 inches. It was 6 inches shorter than a Honda Goldwing from the same time. And that's a motorcycle. The motorcycle is half a foot longer than an entire car. That's how small the original Smart was. And it came in two versions. There was the City Coupe and the Smart Cabrio, which was the convertible version. It had a cloth roof and it slid back along a track. And you also remove the two, you know, tracks. You could remove the roof rails so it wouldn't have any roof at all. And the car was so short that the rails weren't that long. You could store it in the tailgate of the car. It was cool. And a weird design detail that I always think is interesting is the fact that on the early cars, you have the fuel door on the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side, there's a matching round black plastic panel. And you assume it's just for symmetry, you know, to go with the fuel door. But actually, that was the air intake. Because the engine was at the back, it was just a hatchback shape with no obvious way to channel cold air into the engine. So they figured they'd just pull air from the side of the car opposite the fuel door. And I just think that's cool. But anyway, the interiors were really cool, honestly, at least by the standards of the late 90s, because it looked all futuristic, like the inside of a spaceship. Like, it was not like a cool, aggressive spaceship like you'd see in Star Wars. It was more like the kind of soft, friendly, gay spaceship from Little Einsteins. But, you know, just like the rest of the car, the interior was supposed to be fun and unique. And so the upholstery came in a bunch of bright colors, red, orange. A lot of them came in blue for some reason. And the patterns were always weird. Like, it almost looked like it had bus upholstery. You know, at least at first. And the air vents, they came out of the dash and they were just little domes. And the clock and the rev counter came out as little pods, kind of shaped like snail eyes, right out of the middle of the dash. And given that it was a rear-engine car, there was no center tunnel up front. And so the center stack could just, like, follow the same line as the rest of the dash. So there was a space in the middle between the seats. And in that space, Smart put a narrow vertical dash support on which they put mounting holes. You could mount accessories because Smart sold accessories that were kind of modular. You kind of stack them on top of one another and you could buy whatever combination of them you wanted, cup holders, CD storage, ashtrays, whatever you want. And they just all stack and mount on that dash support. And they were on a swivel. And so you could deploy them whenever you wanted. Say you needed a cup holder, just swing it out. You know, you want to get a different CD. You just, it's cool. You know, I don't know why nobody else did that. And again, there's no engine up front. And so this tiny little car had really decent legroom, and the car, you know, it's fairly tall shaped, and so it had decent headroom. And so for being a tiny little car, it actually had a pretty comfortable interior for what it was. And especially when you consider that in the 4.2, the passenger seat sits farther back than the driver's seat, like in a Volkswagen XL1. Like, you can move the seats forward and back like in any other car, so you can have them side by side if you want, but the actual seat rails are farther forward on the driver's side, and I've heard a couple of reasons why. But the main reason is that the car is extremely narrow. And so, you know, you just keep one seat in front of the other to keep people's shoulders from constantly bumping into each other. And I've also heard safety reasons. Like, it's easier for the driver to see out of the passenger side window if the passenger's farther back. You know, and apparently it's safer in a crash to not just be have two people right next to each other. I don't know. It's smart. It's weird. They did it that way. And another unique thing about the 4.2 is that you didn't necessarily need to parallel park. I mean, if you wanted to be a douchebag, which you were because you drove a Smart, you could simply pull in straight perpendicular to the curb because the car was just so short. You could fit reasonably well within the width of another car. They used to say that you could park three Smarts side by side in the same footprint as one regular parallel park car. And something else that's weird. Again, coming back to the names. You know how in every other car, the trim levels are like LX or SE or LE, stuff like that? Well, the Smart brand, you know, the Smart brand name was already kind of silly. The trim levels had to have dumb names too. And so in ascending order of prestige, there was the Pure, there was the Pulse, and the Passion. And so, and you know, those are your trim levels. In other words, if you're in the Smart community and you see somebody with a Pure, you definitely don't want to be their friend. But I'm going to go ahead and take another break. I'll be right back. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. So that was Dump Truck by Blind Melon, which it's kind of an acquired taste. That whole album is an acquired taste soup, really, because you have the first Blind Melon album, which is great. It's really great, but it's just a pretty standard, not standard, but it's a pretty straightforward Southern rock record, and it did really well. I think it went quadruple platinum. And so the band had some money, and they had some free time, and so they figured they'd just do whatever they wanted. And so they just went out and bought a bunch of random instruments, banjos and mandolins and organs and things like that. And, you know, and so they just wrote a couple of songs just to learn how to play those things. And so naturally, the lyrics for a lot of the songs on Soup were about serial killers or driving a car into the river to drown children in the backseat, that kind of thing. You know, and it didn't achieve the same success as the first album. But anyway, another cool thing about the Smart 4-2 is that it offered the ability to swap body panels whenever you wanted. So say you had a yellow 4-2 and you wanted it to be red, you just order some red body panels, and in theory, it wasn't that hard to just swap them over. You know, you could change the color of your car to fit your mood, like a BMW Z1, but just like on the Z1, it was a major pain in the ass and nobody ever did it. But, you know, it was cool. You make your car personalized, you know, you could change the color of your car based on your mood. It was what people liked about Swatch watches, you know, you just personalize it. And so those removable body panels were the body color. But when you think about a smart car, they always have this silver or black C-shaped frame around the doors, because that's the actual structure of the car, because this is a Mercedes. So people with Southern accents probably jump all over any opportunity to say that the Smart is just a death trap because it's so small and it's got no crumple zone, and you're probably gonna get crushed into a million tiny little pieces as soon as you drive by somebody blowing leaves. But the thing is, this is Mercedes, and Mercedes usually tries to stay at the top of the pile when it comes to safety scores. Although, to be fair, safety is a pretty big reason nobody ever tries to make ridiculously tiny cars. So it's hard to package the thing and still have it stand up to a crash. But again, Mercedes, this is literally the company that invented the crumple zone. So they did their best when it came to the safety of the Smart. And it seems like I hear more stories of people surviving crashes in the Smart 4-2 than pretty much any other car, but it's probably just because it's so remarkable and noteworthy and people notice that. But I just mean, it seems like anytime I see a post online where somebody talks about whether or not a Smart is safe, somebody chimes in the comment section telling a story of how their neighbor was driving a Smart and they were hit by an asteroid and the car was perfectly fine. They were durable. And there's a few reasons for that. You know, little things were done to make it safe. They put the ignition switch in the middle of the car, like on a Saab, because the idea is that if you're in a crash, your knee won't just slam into an ignition key. You know, it's a good idea. I don't know why nobody else except Saab did it. Saab was doing it first, of course, but it's a nice idea, I guess. The main thing was the chassis. That was the main safety thing, because Mercedes developed what they called a Tritium safety shell. And it means that the main chassis is just like this cage that wraps around the cabin, and it sort of acts as an exoskeleton to prevent cabin intrusion. You know, the front section of the car was designed to be a crumple zone because there's no engine up front. But the actual frame of the car around the passengers was super tough, you know, and it would protect you in a crash. It was all pretty clever. And so as a result of that, the Smart received 3 out of 5 stars in Euro NCAP testing when it came out. And that doesn't sound amazing, but, like, look at the thing and tell me you think that would get 3 out of 5 stars. And in any case, it was still one of the safest cars you could buy. You know, the Nissan Micra at the time scored 2 stars, as did the Volkswagen Polo. The small car that didn't beat the Smart was Mercedes' own A-Class, although I'd probably also argue that the Smart was safer than that, because if you know the A-Class, you know why. The famous Moose Test incident, because there's a Swedish car magazine that performs what they call the Moose Test, where they set up cones and pretend that there's an obstacle that just suddenly appeared in the road, like, for example, a moose, and then they see how capably the car can swerve to avoid it. So you're going at a decent speed in a straight line, and then you just rip the steering wheel to the left and then rip it back to the right, and you're wanting the car to be pretty much completely flat and stable. But in some cases, the vehicle lifts 1 or 2 wheels off the ground or even blows a tire, like the 2011 Grand Cherokee, and that's very bad. But what's worse than that is the original A-Class went on its roof. It went up on 2 wheels and then no wheels and then on its roof. So was the A-Class actually safer than the Smart, you know? The Smart didn't have that problem, or really many safety problems at all. I mean, the Smart, if it had a safety issue, it was just the fact that it was so damn small. People might not see you. They always tell you that when you ride a motorcycle. It's just don't. You're invisible. the smart probably had a pretty similar problem. And so there were some other smart models, and none of them we got here. I'll start with the Crossblade, because inexplicably, at some point, smart decided that what the market desperately needed was a 4.2 with no roof and no windows, and the doors consisted of some thin bars, which pretty much seemed to exist solely to hold the mirrors. And it didn't really have a windshield. I mean, the Crossblade, the windshield was kind of similar to one of those bug deflectors you see on the hood of a lot of 90s pickups. It was like it had a quote-unquote windshield, arguably, you know. But the thing is, it looked exactly like the concept car it was based on. And for some reason, they decided to make it. And they called it the Crossblade, and they charged 21,000 euros for it, which was about double the price of a regular smart cabriolet. And even crazier is that Smart announced they were going to sell 2,000 of them, which seems optimistic. And craziest thing of all is that they apparently did sell 2,000 of them. I mean, it might have just been a whole load of, you know, Daimler, Chrysler, friends and family discount, but still 2,000 of these things. And it even had a Brabus-tuned engine with 70 horsepower. Not that it mattered. I mean, the thing did 0 to 60 in 16 seconds, but I don't know exactly why anybody bought a Crossblade except to use it as like a fifth car at their beach house. Although I suspect that was already kind of a pretty sizable chunk of Smart's buyers, you know. I think that was maybe Smart's target demographic. I saw a Crossblade out in traffic not that long ago, and I saw it and I absolutely lost my mind. It was the highlight of that month, but I for some reason I can't place exactly 100% where it was. I'm 99% sure it was Palm Beach, because the Crossblade is just peak Palm Beach, you know. And Palm Beach isn't like some of the wealthier neighborhoods in, say, Los Angeles, where people are trying to show off. Like, Palm Beach, everybody's super rich, and you're aware of that, but it's all old money. And so if you stand in one place and you look around, you'll see, like, three Bentley Continentals, but you're not going to see any Lamborghinis or McLarens or anything as vulgar and ostentatious as that. You might see a Ferrari, but it'll be one of the front-engine V12 cars. You know, you're not going to see supercars. And if you do, it's going to be an old 308 or something. You know, people in Palm Beach, for example, I'm setting the stage for who buys a Crossblade. People in Palm Beach, they like expensive cars, but they only buy cars that they like. They don't care what random people think. They're all old and rich enough to not care. You know, they're not insecure about any of it. And so people there buy what they want. And when they want something silly, they have the money to buy it. Like, for example, a smart Crossblade. They just keep it at their little $40 million beach house as like a ninth car for when the weather's nice. And it's great. You know, and the sort of person that lives in Palm Beach generally isn't the person who's out there tearing nasty traffic on I-95. They're just taking a nice, quiet 30-mile-an-hour cruise up Ocean Boulevard. And for that, there is no better vehicle than a roofless smart car with an automated manual. That sort of person is exactly the smart Crossblade's target demo. And that person, and that exact person, is probably why smart Crossblades are like 40 or 50 grand these days. I mean, they're just weird. People want them. I can't argue with it. There's nothing like it. But anyway, moving on. So the same year the Crossblade came out, 2002, Smart decided that they wanted something more sporty and aggressive. So they released the Roadster, which was a little target top sports car, you know, and then they had the Roadster Coupe, which was just a hatchback version of that. And those things were super cool. Underneath, they were still basically just Smarts, and they had that horrible transmission, which is a drag, but It's just a cool-looking little rear-engine, rear-wheel drive convertible. It weighs 1,700 pounds, and it's made by Mercedes-Benz, and it gets 40 miles to the gallon. And I mean, granted, it did 0 to 60 in like 10 seconds, but still, they're cool. And when they came out for a sports car, they were cheap. I mean, 13,000 pounds in the UK when it was new, which at the time was the same as a little Vauxhall Astra, which is, at the time, you know, the little entry-level compact sedan. You know, it was... The thing was a bargain, and it was really cool. And if you were in the market for a cheap sports car in Europe back then, it was a great option. And I occasionally go on Marketplace, and then I set my, my search range. You can put it wherever destination you want. And so I just set it to somewhere in the UK. And so I start looking for smart roadsters because I think they're cool. And so the cars are cheap, you know, and they're running gear straight out of every other smart, so parts are cheap, but the cars are just like, you get them for 2,000 pounds, which is, you know, $2,500. And I was recently looking. I found a Roadster Coupe, and it was a Brabus version, you know, with the cool wheels and more power and whatever, and it was silver. And it was the perfect spec, and the guy wanted 3,000, which is a little under $4,000. I mean, plus shipping, of course, but it's still, if you want a cool car that attracts a lot of attention and is generally just weird and interesting, Smart roasters are going to be legal here in 2 years. I can't wait. I can't wait to see one in person. But 2 years after that, Smart released the 4.4, which was the four-door hatchback. It was the normal size Smart. It was still pretty small, but it was a Mitsubishi Colt underneath. It was, which is a pretty standard small hatchback, you know. As crazy as the other Smarts were, this one really wasn't. The car was fine. It was completely forgettable. And by the way, for whatever reason, there was even a 170 horsepower Brabus version of the 4.4. Because Brabus was all over the small, underpowered Smart cars, which is cool. I mean, good for them. It's, I love that, you know. Do you want a 700 horsepower SL65 AMG, or do you want a tiny little hatchback with some cool wheels? Like, Brabus had you covered. They were your guys. And something that was good about that 4.4, I guess, is that, again, Mitsubishi Colt underneath, you could actually get it with a real manual transmission, which was great. You didn't have to deal with that horrible semi-auto. But the problem the 4.4 had was, why not just buy a Colt? Because for one, the 4.4 was absolutely hideous and didn't really have any advantages over any other small hatchback. So why would you buy it? And that was the way most buyers felt about it. And so in 2007, they redesigned the 4.4.2. And the gas engine got bigger and the diesel engine got slightly more powerful. And they changed the bodywork and the interior. It somehow became even safer. But a lot of it, including the chassis and some of the mechanicals, stayed the same. But for the 2008 model year, they decided they would start selling it in the United States, which seemed like a good enough idea because Americans kind of like stuff like that. I mean, keep in mind, the Volkswagen New Beetle was designed by and for the U.S. market. We buy cutesy little stuff like that. And so when they decided they were going to sell Smarts in the U.S., they figured they'd sell the 4.2, and then they were also going to come out with a small SUV called the 4.more. Well, that obviously never happened. Bringing Smart to the U.S. market was probably a mistake, because in general, we didn't really buy them. Like, Smarts in the United States were popular in the strictest dictionary definition of the word popular, but nobody here bought them. Most people knew what they were. They thought they were interesting, but it didn't translate to sales at all. I mean, I'm not saying it was a total flop. It really wasn't, because in the U.S., they sold, in the U.S., just about every other market, they sold just about well enough to keep selling them here, and they quit selling Smart here in 2019 when they discontinued the 4.2, and Smart just pulled out of the U.S. market. In other countries, they made an electric version of the 4.2 up until last year, but nobody was buying that either. But 2019 was also the same year that Mercedes sold half of Smart to Geely, which is a Chinese company. They own Volvo now. And so Geely moved Smart manufacturing to China, and so they shut down Smartville, which is sad. And they sold it to Ineos, which that's where Ineos makes the Grenadier, the kind of new retro modern Land Rover Defender thing. But I guess Geely feels like Smart is a good name and it's a reputable brand, despite the fact that they no longer make the cars that made them famous. Like, Smart still makes cars, just not the Smart car that everybody knows. They have the Smart number 1, the number 3, and the number 5, all of which are crossover EVs. The actual Smart car is dead. It failed. And so, why did the Smart car fail? I talked about how the cars were slow and the transmissions were bad, but it could have overcome that. You know, plenty of cars do. But really the main problem it had was it wasn't what you'd call competitively priced. And that's not to say it was expensive or that people didn't buy it, but it, you know, it's a, like a Swatch. It's supposed to be basically a fashion accessory. You were paying for the style. It was a cool piece of engineering and it attracted a lot of attention and people liked it a lot. But as an actual car, there were plenty of better options for the money. And that's really what it comes down to. It wasn't ridiculously expensive. Quite the opposite. It was extremely cheap, actually, even for a car. But when it comes down to it, it still costs car money. You know, if you're spending car money, why would you buy a little two-door, two-seat, three-cylinder car with an annoying transmission and no cargo space and is capable of 84 miles an hour? What I mean is, okay, when they first started selling the 4.2 here in the U.S. in 2008, the MSRP was about $11,500, which was very, very cheap. But the base price of a Toyota Corolla that year was $14,500, which, okay, obviously the Corolla is way more expensive, clearly, but the Corolla is way more car. You know, if you're spending 12 grand on a brand new, small, economical car, wouldn't you probably also be willing to spend 15 grand on a brand new, bigger, more reliable, more practical, similarly economical, vastly more comfortable and usable car? And for most people, the answer was yes. But, you know, for some, the answer was no. Most of those people weren't buying the Smart as a car. It was just a fashion statement, just like God intended. And that was a big enough demographic. I mean, they generally sold about 100,000 a year, which isn't bad. It was like half of what they were hoping for. But remember, this, it's supposed to be a city car bought by the masses. They wanted to sell it in big numbers. But still, 100,000 a year is not that bad. It just wasn't really anything to get all that excited about. It was a neat little experiment. It's just one of those, the smart car is just one of those little cars that everybody knows about and they think it's weird, but nobody ever actually thinks about it, like the PT Cruiser or the Subaru Baja, stuff like that. And so all in, Mercedes lost about $5 billion on the Smart 4.2 over the years. And it was a failure. As interesting as it was a failure. And that's, you know, that's sad. But anyway, that's pretty much all I got. That's almost the end of the show. So this is the last show I'm going to be doing here for about a month because me and a buddy are taking a motorcycle trip down south for 10 to 14 days. And it's scheduled in such a way that we'll leave in the middle of one week and we'll get back at the end of the next or perhaps the beginning of the following week. So that's two Mondays I'm not going to be here. And then technically I'll still be here in Monday. I'll still be here in Missouri next Monday, but I'm not going to have enough time to put a show together to do this and also do everything I have to do to prepare because I got a little over a week. I still got to pack and I got to prep the bike and I'm going to have the rear tire swapped out. And the main thing is I bought the bike like 6 months ago and I never even bothered to get it registered, which, you know, I bought the thing out of state. So that means I have to get it inspected too, which is annoying. And if I was just riding around here, I wouldn't really care if it was registered or not because I've gotten a couple of tickets for having stuff not registered before. It's like $70, which isn't nothing, but it's, you know, $70. You know, how much is the sales tax you got to pay on the thing to get it registered? How many tickets can you get before it adds up to sales tax? You know, you get a bunch of tickets before it actually adds up to getting the thing registered. And it's still on the temp tags, and they're out-of-state temp tags, so nobody knows how to read them. And even if they do, the actual expiration date's the size of a AA battery. So I'd probably be fine just to do the whole 4,000 miles just riding dirty, but I'm not gonna if I can help it. Anyway, I gotta go do all that, so I'll be back. I guess it's February, so I'll be back in exactly a month. So anyway, this was fun. I had fun this show, so I'm gonna go ahead and run through the damn radio schedule. So where is it? So Tuesday. The two shows, the two anchor shows, 5 days a week, 2 to 4, Really Big Shoe with JR, 4 to 5:30, International Flavor with Sam Trapp. Then Wednesday, the biggest show on damn radio, or the biggest day on damn radio, 9 to 10, The Damn Schwag, 11 to 1, The Gabby Hayes Show, 6 to 8, The Ike Skelton Radio Show. Thursday, 6 to 8, The Fitzwell Factor. Friday, Nadine at 9, you have, and her guest is the show's about satanic drag shows on college campuses. I don't know. I'm sorry. I apologize. I don't know how to pronounce that name. Grace Hosmanek. And then 6 to 8, Eye of the Beholder with Pauly. Great show. They're all great shows. You're listening to This Was Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.